Let's start. Welcome to this brand new lecture on virtual machines in this week. What did we do last? So last we started to attack the most complicated the most complicated feature provided by Prolog, which is backtracking. So failing is always the most the hardest issue. As you all know, whenever you fail an exam, you have to backtrack, go back to learning, and hopefully have a second try and then succeed. So the same thing here. And recall, what does it mean to backtrack? Backtracking means that we failed with our attempt to prove a predicate, and therefore all the intermediate computations we have done, we have to roll back. And what does it mean, computation which we have done? Well, computation which we have done has consisted in doing certain unifications of terms and introducing certain bindings of variables. And now at some point we find, okay, we arrive at a pair of terms which cannot be unified. So we have been on the wrong path. And so we roll back to the last occasion where we had another alternative to try. And all bindings of variables which we have introduced in between must be undone. So that means rollback. And for that, and the point where there the last, dynamically last point where there is an open alternative which we can try or which we have to try now, next, this is the backtrack point. And these variables, now which kind of, how do we find the variables which we have to undo? And these variables have been, or we took care of these variables by means of trailing them. And we trailed them by calling the runtime function trail. And that runtime function trail, we should now take a closer look at. So what does the trail do? So the first thing is, for this this functionality, we have introduced a separate data structure, which is the trail. And the trail pointer points to the last element in this data structure, allocated on this data structure, and the data structure is maintained like a stack. Okay, so that's this one. And so that is the situation of the runtime stack. So no, for that I think no, that we have already seen. I guess resetting. Now we are here. Okay. Remembered. Okay. So I guess here we have to continue. So now we have, I said, we have to look at this functionality trail. And the function trail is called for an address U, which is an address in the heap and points to an R object, which is a variable. And now the question is, which kind of variables should we record on our data structure trail? And so the idea is that we consider the last value of the trail pointer, meaning the trail pointer which we have stored at the backtrack point. This we find by looking up the value S of BP minus 2. BP is the current backtrack pointer, and this points to the stack, to the stack frame where there is an alternative open. Inside this stack frame, we have recorded the old trail pointer. That is the trail pointer when allocating, when installing the backtrack point. Yeah? So we have this trail pointer down there. This is kind of, in some sense, the variables sit all up to that point. All the variables will survive the backtracking. And everything, all the variables which have been introduced or bound afterwards, these are the candidates to be undone. Yeah? So therefore, we only check whether the variable which we bind here is an old variable. So that is, it is an old variable. That is whether it is the address is smaller. I said something wrong. So this beast here is not the old trail pointer, but the old heap pointer. Sorry, this is the old heap pointer, which we also have recorded at the backtrack point, and that means all variables whose addresses are less than this heap pointer have been allocated earlier, before installing the last backtrack point. So therefore, they will survive the backtracking. So that this means that if I have such an old variable, so it is in the old heap, and therefore will not be popped away. So if I have this old variable, and if I bind that in the critical computation, then I record this variable on the trail. Yeah, I record those variables which are not in that heap, which is popped away when backtracking occurs. These are trail. Okay. So this is the mystery between the trailing. And now the resetting, what does the resetting mean? This was the other thing which we have to do when we do backtracking. So for that, we compare, resetting is called for two addresses, and these addresses now are these are two indices of within the trail. So the X is the so this is the lower address in the trail, and this is the higher address in the trail. And between these two addresses in the trail sit all the variables which have been bound in the intermediate computation, which is now undone. So therefore, I iterate from X to Y, or in the from Y to X, so from the upper end in the trail to the lower end. I iterate downwards and unbind the corresponding variables, which means I set the variables whose addresses are sitting on the trail to themselves. So this means I introduce a self loop for all these variables. So this means they are unbound afterwards. Okay? So is it somehow clear? So once again, so I have the old heap and I have the new heap, which is now will be popped away. But all the variables in the old heap, which have been bound, they are unbound. Okay. So now wrapping it up. What how does we organize the implementation of a predicate? So here is a predicate, Q with arity K, and assume that it is implemented by means of multiple clauses. So say F clauses, where F is at least 2. Then the first thing which we have to do when we start evaluating a literal, start evaluating a literal for Q, so the first thing is we have to set the backtrack point. Yeah, because we will go then for the R1, but if R1 fails, we have to continue with R2 and so on. So therefore, we have to initialize somehow the backtrack point. This is the first thing. Then we have to take precautions that we successively iterate through the alternatives at failure. Okay, and in the end, we have to delete the backtrack point. So the code, therefore, for the predicate Q with defined by the sequence R1 to RF, which is the RR, RR, this is this sequence R1 to RF. So this looks as follows. We first have the label of the corresponding to the predicate. Then we have to install the backtrack point. This is by this set BTP. Then we successively try the alternatives. We don't know yet how to do it, but we introduce for that a new instruction try. And so we try A1, then we try A2, then we try A3. And so on. This we do until the last alternative, but until the second but last alternative. So this is this AF minus two, minus one. And then afterwards, after there's only one alternative left. So this single alternative is so. At that point, we know when this last alternative fails, then it's no longer possible to return or to look for another alternative for this predicate. Therefore, we can delete the predicate before the last alternative, and the last alternative then is simply jumped to. So therefore, the last alternative is not tried, but directly unconditionally jumped to. Yeah? And when this last alternative fails, then execution will return to the dynamically to the backtrack point, which has been dynamically installed before this one. So we will not return to it. Yeah? So therefore we can jump. Okay, and then here down there below, we find just the sequence of the codes, the concatenation somehow of the codes for the various alternatives. So for the various, so these are the various, these are the codes for the clauses. This means the possible implementations of the Q. Yeah, and so this is kind of instead of one as we had it in C or in a functional language, we have multi. We have F different implementations, so F different clauses, and so we have the codes for these, and the labels A1 to AF allow to access these. Yeah? So that is, so the, we know how the blue thing down there can be implemented. The only thing which now remains to look at is this one, and this one, and this one. This jumping we know. Okay. So now let us see how the, just for an example, how the code looks like. Again, for we take the liberty of generating code before we really understand how the instructions are implemented. Because so if we have a code like this, so we have S has two alternatives. So the how does the code for the predicate S look like? So first we have to set the backtrack point. Then we try the first alternative. Yes, but then there's only one alternative left, so we already delete the backtrack point in the next step and jump to the last alternative. This is the B. Now, and now A is the address of the first alternative. So this is T applied T of X. So X is a formal parameter and therefore initialized. Therefore, this bar on top of the X. And so therefore, the implementation of the first clause looks as, what is it? So it is push env 1 because there's only one local. And then the code for the literal in the body. In the literal in the body is just F applied to X. So we mark mark a stack frame. See the first address after behind that when the literal succeeds. Then we have to do the actual parameter, build up the actual parameter. This is just X. So therefore put ref 1. And then we call the T1. So that's the code for the literal in the body of the first clause. And then the code for the first clause continues by popping the environment. That's it. So this A, so this blue thing, therefore, is the code for the first clause. And now the code for the second clause is here. So this is X equals A. So this is just the fact. S of A, if you like. So the code for that is, so there's again just one local variable, therefore push env 1. And then we have to do the code for the unification goal. That is, we first put the reference to X, which is put ref 1, because X is already initialized. Yeah, so therefore put ref 1. And then we kind of generate unification code for the right-hand side. And that is just, this is particularly easy here because it's just an atom. So therefore, U atom A. So this gives us the code for the right-hand side. And afterwards, again, we do the pop-inf. Okay? So that is the code for the for this predicate. Now this, so we are now already in the advanced stage, so we can kind of fully translate the code for predicates. Still, we do not yet know how this setting and deleting of backtrack points look like, so it was the wind perhaps. Ah, no, that was not the wind. No, you only have to push harder. At least I pushed harder and it worked. So, anyway, so now let's look what the setting of a backtrack point, what it does. So, recall that when doing the setting of the backtrack point means, so we have the frame pointer is set to a stack frame, and we have some current values for the heap pointer, for the trail pointer, and for the backtrack pointer. And now setting the backtrack point means nothing else but recording the values of these three registers inside the stack frame. So that's it, because that we have to put. And also, that is one thing. And additionally, there's one more thing which we have to do. The backtrack point now is the same as the current frame pointer. Because now we have something where there is more than one alternative. So therefore we have a new backtrack point, and therefore the old backtrack point we have restored in our stack frame, and that's the situation. That's all. So in a sense, it is again the setting of a backtrack point. Also, perhaps, or at least I might, was a little bit when I looked at it and said, oh, how could I implement it? Might be complicated, but you see, it's easy. It's not so difficult. Okay, so now this try thing, what does that mean? So trying, so I have what does the instruction try A mean? So A is the address of the alternative which we have to try. So therefore, this A kind of must go into the PC. Okay, so that's the first thing. Now the question is, what happens if this alternative fails? So if this alternative failed, so there was here, in this place, this was the negative continuation address. Now this kind of thing is now is changed, so that we must change. Because now we go to the alternative A, and therefore we have now to put into this place, here, the next alternative, which we have to try. Now what is it? How do we find it? Now in fact, what do you see here? This, the value there, which we store in this place, is just the current PC. What is the PC? When the try is executed, the PC has already been increased by 1. So this, the value 29 here, is the instruction behind the current try. So what kind of instruction do we have behind the try? Let us quickly go back. Okay, so it's the next try. And that's fine. So when we have done the first alternative, and then if it fails, which instruction do we have to execute next? The next try. And that by that we cycle through the tries. Yeah, we iterate through all the alternatives. So in this sense, you see suddenly that this try instruction is also very simple. It just means the A becomes the new PC and the old PC is stored as a negative continuation address. Okay? Any question? So that's this. And now it only remains to look what happens at the delete backtrack point. When we delete the backtrack point, what happens there? Okay, deleting the backtrack point means that somehow the current pointer of the backtrack to the backtrack point is not so it points to the current stack frame. Yes, when we delete it, it simply means this is no longer the current backtrack point, and that kind of do we take care of by putting this one over there. We just move, restore the old backtrack pointer, and that's it. Also very simple. Okay? And, So that, by that, we have now, in some sense, fully explained the Prolog engine up to one thing, and that is the instruction popenv. Pushenv we had, popenv we have not yet explained. So, what was this popenv thing good for? It was the last instruction of a clause. Now, the first instruction of the clause, this was this just a recall of what we have seen already. The first instruction that was this pushenv m. M is the number of locals. By that, we kind of set the space for the locals. Then comes the code for the body. That's here. And now comes, and in the end, we place this popenv thing, and we hoped that this gives up the stack frame. But then the question is, when can we give up the current stack frame? Okay, we can give up the current stack frame whenever we are sure we will never return to it. Now, so when will we not return to the current stack frame? So what is in this current stack frame? There is, in particular, the current stack frame contains the pointers to the actual parameters to the current predicate. So if we have P applied to terms, so think of a literal, I write down now some, any literal, so T1, T2, So, and for this literal, we have installed a stack frame. So when are we sure that we will not return to this stack frame? So we can only be sure that we will not return to this stack frame if it is no backtrack point. If we are positively done with it, and it is not a backtrack point. Because if it's a backtrack point, we might backtrack to it. So this is, so in this sense, we can only pop the stack if we cannot pop over a backtrack point. Yeah? So therefore, if this, the predicate which we are currently evaluating should, the clause which we are currently evaluating for the predicate P should be not, should be the last clause or the only clause, then we are sure we will not return to this predicate. If we succeed, therefore we can pop it. Now that is the one thing, but it could also be that, so we had the last, so this was the last clause of the predicate P, but in the course of, in the body of this clause, there were other literals which installed backtrack points on the stack. Now then, if we finished, if we successfully reached the endpoint of this clause, okay, we might not return, take another clause for this predicate, but we might take other clauses for the literals in the body of that clause. So we cannot just pop the stack frame, because we might have to try other alternatives inside the body of that. So therefore, we can only, we can only pop a stack frame if the backtrack point, so I'll now make a picture. So here is my fabulous stack frame. And now on top of it, there are a lot of others. Now, which color should I make it? Oh, I make them black. So here is a backtrack point. Here is a literal with a backtrack point. And in between are harmless computations. Yeah. So this is, these kind of things have remained on top of the stack. And now my stack pointer is currently here. And I'm finished with the stack frame, the literal corresponding to the red stack frame down there. So this means in particular, by that, you see now why I think 2 weeks ago or so, I said, yes, the locals can be arbitrarily far away from the stack pointer. Why? Because on top of the red stack frame, which is our stack frame, there are we had to keep stack frames with open alternatives, backtrack points on top of it. So therefore now we are up here, but our current stack frame is down there. And we cannot pop because there are open alternatives. Only, so if we then later in the far future fail with our variable bindings, then we might have to return to this stack frame here and kind of choose another alternative, introduce other variables and so on. And only if we are able to pop off this one and that one, we will ultimately kill the red stack frame. Yeah? So that is, therefore, the check whether we can pop a stack frame is if the current backtrack pointer is below. So this should be the backtrack pointer, and this should be the frame pointer. Only if we have this situation, then we have successfully terminated a clause for the red literal, then we are allowed to pop. Okay? Could you understand that? So that is one of the reasons why these Prolog machines are so space-consuming, because they are not allowed to pop the stack frame when they are positively done with a call. Okay. So therefore, accordingly, this pop-env instruction, so the good case is, so it first has to check this one here. So this is kind of the check which we have to to do inside the instruction popenv. And if this succeeds, then we are allowed, okay, then we give up the current stack frame. Yes, and then we give up the current stack frame, and that means simply we kind of pop the stack, and the old frame pointer, here it is, this moves into the, no, this is the old frame pointer, the old frame pointer moves into, becomes the new frame pointer. Yes, this moves here, and the old PC, the positive continuation address, goes into the PC, and then computation proceeds. This is what we would have expected ordinarily when we terminate a when the evaluation of a clause succeeded. So this is the good case when we really are allowed to deallocate a stack frame. But there are situations when this is not possible, namely when this check fails. And this means if the frame pointer, so this is this situation. The code here is completely, is already complete. So here the stack pointer goes then to the first address, so all this is popped off. That is in the positive case, but in all cases, this part we may execute in all cases. So when we are, but in some, the popping of the stack may only occur, may not always be possible, but only under this precondition here. So therefore, this is in the case where there is a backtrack point still at the frame pointer or above the frame pointer, the stack pointer is not changed, but still these two instructions happen, namely we kind of continue with the positive continuation address and we return to the old, to the stack frame indicated by the old frame pointer. Yeah. Okay, so that was kind of the popping. Now we know how to implement predicates. The only thing now what remains is to get to look at the full program. So now what is the full program? The full program consists of predicate definitions, of definitions of predicates. This is this RR1 to RRH, and then followed by a query G. Now, what do we expect from that? So there is clearly a code for the predicates. The code for the program should contain the code for the predicates. Okay, that we know how to do. Then clearly there's this the query G. How to implement a single query we also know. This is this one. And then what happens with the result of that query? This will bind the variables in this G. And then we expect that there is a kind of instruction halt. So that is should kind of print the bindings for the globals for the variables occurring in G to the screen. So this is what you get by the from a Prolog interpreter. When you ask a query, does P of X hold? Then you get an answer saying X equals A, if A is a possible binding for which the query can be concluded. Okay, so that is the one thing, and if this fails, so then you can, you can typically press return, and that means this pressing return will trigger a re-evaluation of the the query and another solution for another binding for the variable occurring in for the variables occurring in G will be looked for, and if there is no further possibility to prove the query G, then the answer is no. So that is what we the code looks like, and the answer is no. Yeah, that is and printing the instruction, printing this. Failure information onto the screen. This is done by the instruction no. Okay. So what do we have to now? What do we have to write into the code? Well, there is first we have to do some kind of initialization of registers and allocating space for the variables in G. And the variables in G we might consider as globals, because they are kind of outside of the predicates, and in the end, additionally, we have to return the values of these globals. So therefore, at least one possibility to organize the code for the full program looks like that. It consists of the code for the predicates. Okay. Then it consists of we have to initialize somehow to do some initializations. For that I kind of provided this instruction in it. And this also kind of sets a initial, if you like, sets an initial stack frame. And the A is the negative continuation address, so therefore this A points to no, instruction no. And otherwise, and then we also have this instruction halt. Inside then, after the init follows that we push, that we introduce space for the variables occurring in the query G, assuming that there are D elements in that, we make a push env D. Then comes the code for the literal G that we know how to do, and then in the end we do the halt. So this halt thing also is a new instruction. This halt thing simply should say, what does it do? Okay, so for that I have no implementation, but only kind of description. So if we do this holding, then I have given to halt this argument D, which means that the instruction should terminate the program execution, and terminating program execution means handing over control to the operating system, and before that returning the bindings of the globals, and in this case these should be perhaps D globals. There's a little bit more, there's a little bit of a problem here, because as usual interaction with the user is the most problematic thing of a program. So if the program had no users, there were a lot less problems. So the first thing is the user has kind of the idea that the variables have names, and clearly in order to return the bindings you have to memorize somewhere the names of the globals and print them. So you want to read x equals and then the term, and you not want to read underscore 25 equals a. Yeah. So this means here the runtime system somehow has to do preparations which refer also to the syntax of the program, namely recording the names of the globals. Otherwise, no nice output can be produced. Okay, so this is perhaps a minor point, but still important when you really want to use it. Okay, so then then the halt has returned these globals, and returning control to the operating system also means that the user may interact and that he could press the return key, and that means I'm not satisfied with the solution, please give me another one. And then backtracking must be caused. So that is kind of the effect of the instruction halt. Okay, now what is the instruction init? So that is the, you see here we have this init and the no. That's, these are the two kind of placeholders which are still, and we still have to provide. So the init thing, what should it do? So assuming that the frame pointer initially is, well, there is nothing on the stack, so frame pointer is -1. The heap pointer perhaps points to 0 if it points to the first free address. The trail pointer is also -1 because the trail is empty, and backtrack pointer is also -1 because it is the backtrack pointer is also a pointer into the stack. Okay, now the initialization should set up an initial stack frame. So the initial stack frame, here it is. So in particular, it should kind of initialize the negative continuation address, which is the A. And, okay, so these two the informations is not very important. This is the old, the old trail pointer and the old backtrack pointer, and here the old heap pointer. So these are kind of do not have very valuable information. With the old trail pointer, that is a valuable information. Yeah, because when the first, when you have then a new trail, a current trail pointer, and you want to pop all, to undo all the bindings, then you have to refer to the old trail pointer, and that is -1, and this means all the elements in the trail will be unbound. Okay, so these are important things. And then on top of it, we do not know very much because this is the old frame pointer, and okay, so that we will probably not return to. And the old PC, this we will never access, so therefore no initialization there. But what we will set is the backtrack pointer will be equal to the current frame pointer, will be equal to the current stack pointer, and that all these values will be 5. Okay? And, yeah, so that is the situation. Okay? This is the init, and now the only thing is the no, and the no simply says no, I guess. I have no implementation of the function no, of the instruction no. Okay, so now it's time. So we look at a complete program. So here is a very interesting and amazingly complicated, very simple Prolog program, and we may see how we will implement it. The first thing which we see is that not every predicate here in a Prolog program is really defined by multiple clauses, but in fact here in this example, most of the predicates are implemented by a single clause. So in that sense, they kind of are abbreviations for a sequence of literals or goals. So here this one is the only one which is really a predicate which is defined by means of several clauses, and for these we will have to do this try chain. And for the others, there's just the code for the predicate equals the code for the clause. And now, so speaking aside, this is okay, this is not completely typical. In most Prolog programmers tend to define their predicates by multiple clauses, but often these are still deterministic, and we will kind of come back to that in a minute. So this means that for most of the predicates, still no backtracking will, most of the predicates will not require backtracking. And that is kind of not kind of a deficiency, but a kind of deliberate choice by the skilled Prolog programmer, because backtracking is expensive, and also a Prolog programmer will try to write his code as deterministic as possible by various techniques, and one of the techniques is to use, for example, cuts and things like that. So that's kind of for the general philosophy. Now let us come back to this very concrete program and see how we translate it. So the first thing is, we have this, again, this everything starts with the init, and the n is the address of the node. So this is here, and then we have the code for the query. The query is just this predicate p, which has no arguments. So therefore, it is implemented by push env 0, then we mark the stack frame for the evaluation of the predicate p, and since there are no arguments to put, we directly call the predicate with arity 0, and then immediately proceed with the halt. And halt 0 because no output is made. Now, again, sorry for all my side remarks, but that in that sense it is not completely unrealistic. Most Prolog programs, professional Prolog programs, start with the main predicate without arguments. Why? Because also Prolog programs typically will not be used in this interactive mode, but will be used in such a way that they write some results to file and read from file and so on. And that is the kind of... typically process larger amounts of data or problems, which then cannot be just inserted on the by a query in the shell, but where the answer is so complicated that it does not make sense to present the answer directly on the shell, but better write it to some file in some format and then let some other things do the output in a convenient way. So in that sense, it is not completely uncommon that the main query is in fact something without parameters, without arguments. Okay, so that was kind of the main query. Now what come and the main query and this initialization and halting, and now the only thing what remains is the code, the concatenation of the code for the predicates. So the first thing is the predicate T. T is defined by a unique clause, therefore the code for the T is just the code for the single clause, and that is the clause has one variables, therefore push env 1. Then we have this x equals b, and x is in the head, therefore it is initialized, therefore put ref 1, and then u atom b. This is, and afterwards the pop env, and that is the code for the predicate t. Now comes the code for the predicate p. P, so it is again defined by a single clause, so therefore it is again defined by therefore the code for the predicate is the code for the clause, and therefore it is now one variable, therefore push env 1, and then we have to do the literal q of x, so we mark a stack frame, x is uninitialized at that point, therefore we put the variable 1, and then we call the predicate q. This is the first literal. Now comes the second literal. So the second literal is, again, we mark a stack frame. And C is the positive continuation address. Then now again X, but X is now initialized. Therefore, I put ref 1 and then the call to T. And afterwards, we try to pop the stack frame. Therefore, pop env. That's it. That's the code for the predicate P. Now comes the predicate Q again, so it's the same exercise. Q is defined by a single clause. Therefore, we again can now define the use the code for the clause of Q. So again, a single local variable, therefore push env 1, and then in the body a single literal, we mark the stack frame, x is initialized, therefore put ref 1, and then the call. And afterwards we give up the stack frame, or we try to give up the stack frame, therefore pop env. Okay? And then comes the code for the S, and now I'm a little bit exhausted. I will not read to you. I explain to you the code for the S. Why? I have already shown it to you on a few slides ago. So therefore, all of that is together the code for the predicate S, and I only want to highlight one thing, namely that this one here is the code for the predicate which installs this try chain, where the different alternatives are tried, and the alternatives are E and F. And so this is E, the alternative E, the code for the alternative E, and here the code for the alternative F. Okay? So this makes the so in this sense, I would say the code for a Prolog program looks very neat. Although the control is a bit complicated, because at every point where we unification, at every unification point, a backtracking might be triggered, and then the whole machinery of rolling back is initialized, and which is reflected in the code by these try chains in the predicates. Is there a question? So for that, in order to understand, to get a better feeling for that, I really encourage you to use this VAM. Who has ever used the simulator VAM for his code? So probably you find that this is, at least here, I find it very convenient just to see what operationally happens, because by that some of these things get a little bit clearer, and this kind of this piling up of the stack, for example, and that only in some situations the stack can be popped. Okay, so that is the basic engine, and that's kind of the stripped Prolog machine, and it is, as is, not usable, because you have to insert all these optimizations, otherwise it's way too slow. And so here we do the most important optimizations, actually, which make it, I would say, already these optimizations make it a quite realistic machine. And the first and most important very important optimizations. The first thing is a last call optimization, and the second thing is a optimization of to make programs more deterministic, which is this clause indexing. So these two things together, kind of, if you insert that, then you arrive at a quite realistic machine. So let us first take a look at this last call optimization. This corresponds to this tail recursive thing which we had for functional programs and for functional languages. And it is, as it is, the same reason why we want to do it, because we have no loops. But as I repeatedly explained to you, Prolog is notoriously space consuming, and we want to have something what the programmer can systematically use in order to have something like a loop, which means a constant memory iteration. And this is by means of last calls. Now, what is a last call here? So in a functional language, it is a function call inside the body of another function call which returns the result. So one does not have to return to the surrounding call. And now here, we do not return results. But we have something like a least last call here. This is a last call. Why? Yeah? It is a last call because it is the in this clause, it is the last literal, so that means if this succeeds, this clause is done. So we do not have to return to it. But this does not mean, but now this is prologue, this does not mean that we kind of may not return to this to the current stack frame. Why? Because it is not completely clear whether this clause which we are looking at is the last clause. If it is, if there's another alternative, we still might want to return to this stack frame. Yeah? So, but here in this case, it is not only the last literal, but it is the last literal in the last clause. So here we are completely sure that we will never return to this stack frame again. Yeah? So the what we're looking at is at last goals in a clause. And this is a last this is a last call, and we try, the goal will be to evaluate it in the current stack frame. And after successful completion, we then hopefully will not return to the current caller. That is the idea. And so now consider, so now let us see. So here is a clause, the code for a clause. And here is the last literal. And then let us, now we do the following. We do, we write here the, this is the code for the full, for this, for the whole clause R. So we put the play, the memory, the space for the locals, and then we successively put the code for the goals. And we do so in the thread, in the way how we did it before, for the n minus 1 first goals, and then comes now the last literal. And the last literal there, okay, so the last literal looks like that. We first mark the mark it, then in the end we do the pop env, and in between we first put the actual parameters, and then we call. So that's what we do, and you see we pop the environment after the call. Now and we have an so kind of what is significant here, we introduce a new stack frame, and then we pop the old stack frame afterwards. So the idea is we would like to do this popping at the marking. So therefore we combine, we kind of integrate it into a last mark thing, and we try to avoid this pop env. So kind of one might think of that that goes already here into this last mark, and this last call is in some sense we try to use. For the last call, we try to reuse the surrounding stack frame. So therefore, we introduce a new instruction, which we call last call. And this instruction also receives the number of locals in the surrounding stack frame, because this is the space which we might want to squeeze out of the stack. Yeah, because the locals, we will, if we kind of can reuse the old stack frame, which in particular means that we can that we do not require the old locals anymore, we can squeeze them out. So now let us, so that using this kind of rewriting, we arrive at this kind of code. Here we have this, instead of the marking, we have this last mark thing, and instead of the calling here and the pop env, we have this last call thing. And no pop env in the end. Okay? So here, what does this last mark mean? So the last mark is, so we have to check. The last mark has to check whether we can reuse the current stack frame or not. How can we check it? Okay. How can we check that we can reuse the current stack frame? Well, we can do, the check is this one. When the current frame pointer is larger than the backtrack pointer. This means that all backtracking is down here. In particular, this means that the current stack a frame is not a backtrack point. And that means if this clause is done, it is done. So therefore, we do not return to it. So this is the good case. So therefore, if the backtrack point is below, then we can kind of give up the stack frame and reuse it directly. So the other thing is, if the backtrack pointer were above the current stack frame, okay, so then we cannot reuse the current stack frame because that means kind of squeezing something down there into the stack, which we cannot do. So therefore, this is the right check. So if this is not the case, okay, so then the last mark should behave like the ordinary marking. This means, in that case, so if this red thing here is not the case, then this means that the frame pointer is less or equal to the backtrack pointer, then we have to allocate the stack frame. That means we have to increase the stack pointer by 6, and then we have to insert the positive and the negative continuation address. So what is the positive continuation? The positive continuation address is the positive continuation address of the surrounding call, because this is the last call, and then we kind of, if everything goes right, then this clause succeeds. We cannot give the stack frame, but we can jump afterwards to the place where we would have jumped anyway. So therefore, we just we can put the positive continuation address, which we find here. We can push it on top of the stack and copy it into the current stack frame. Yeah, we can copy it into the current stack frame. And the frame point, the old frame pointer, that is the old frame pointer of the on the positive side, we will not return to this stack frame, only in the negative side. So then we go to the backtrack pointer. So therefore, the old frame pointer of the caller is also the old frame pointer of our current stack frame. And that's it. Yeah? And backtrack pointer stays the same. Okay, so that is if we cannot reuse the current stack frame, but we can reuse the positive continuation address and we can reuse the old frame pointer. That's it. And if now that is the if we did not succeed to reuse, and if we succeed to reuse, then in that sense we do not do anything. So then the last marking will do nothing simply. Okay, we come to the last call thing. So the last call, there is two situations to be considered. The first thing is, if we could reuse the current stack frame and have not introduced extra backtrack points, that we can again check by comparing the frame pointer with the backtrack pointer. If the frame pointer is less or equal to the backtrack point, then this is the bad situation. We have bad luck. And then the last call is the same as the call. So we do the call. Otherwise, the good case is that the frame pointer is that the frame pointer is larger than the backtrack pointer, so that is also if the frame pointer is larger than the backtrack pointer, then this is the good case, and in that case we can reuse the current stack frame. In that way, that the locals can be of the caller can be squeezed out, and our own locals, which we have created, can be moved in their place. So this means this is achieved by this instruction move MH. So this means these H variables are moved M memory cells downward. H is the number of of locals on top of the stack, of actual parameters on top of the stack. They are moved m memory cells down. These m memory cells correspond to the locals of the surrounding call. And then, now then, this last call is not is nothing. There is the last call can simply be jumped to. That is also an important thing, that we can jump to it. So this is like at the end of the body of the while, we can jump back. So this is a jump. Okay? So here you see the code for the last call. If we kind of hope to move the M locals on top of the stack, the M arguments downwards, M cells downward. So actually here's a little bit, you move it down. I guess these brackets here somehow are stupid, so they can be removed. Okay. So that's the, in some sense, the whole thing. And now let us look at, for example, at this particular at this clause. And here we have the recursion from A to A through the last call. And doing the optimization thus means we put the code for the clause looks as follows. We first, there are three locals, therefore we push N3. Then we do the first literal, the code for the first literal. This is this one here. So first we mark the stack frame. A is the positive continuation address. We put the X by put ref 1. Then we put the X1. X1 is a fresh variable, therefore put var 3. And it's the third variable, therefore it's 3. And then we call the predicate F with arity 2. And now comes the code for the last call. And therefore we have this last mark. Then we do the arguments in the usual way. And then we have this last call, A/2. And then how many variables do we have to squeeze out? Well, the surrounding clause has three variables. Therefore, we have this three thing here. Okay, that's it. And there's another thing which is interesting. If the clause is the last clause, if this clause here, so you note that the optimization only referred to the last call with respect to the surrounding clause. And this clause could occur in different places inside the surrounding predicate. And this, the code for this last optimization is not affected from that. But if we also know that this clause is not only does not occur somewhere in the list of clauses for the predicate A, but is the last clause, then we can do a little bit more. Because then we know if it is the last clause, then these testing things which are inside the, which take place in the last mark and in the last call, they are no longer, they can be in some cases avoided. For example, if we are sure that this literal or this goal, the goals before additionally do not introduce backtrack points, and it is the last clause, then every backtrack point must be before. So in that sense, we can kind of replace last mark with nothing. Yeah, we can skip it. It's simply not necessary. And last call, then the test can also be squeezed out, which means the last call becomes a move followed by a jump. And that is kind of the utmost optimization, because by that kind of really the right-hand side of the clause becomes if it is recursive, we obtain a loop. This is in particular the case for the up predicate, because here the recursive clause is the last one, it is the second, and the recursion goes through the last literal, and before it is only a unification goal. And this unification does not introduce a backtrack point. It may introduce backtracking, but it does not install an extra stack frame where one might return to it. Yeah? So in that case, we can really, the recursive call becomes a jump, and the code for the last literal does not receive an extra stack frame, but the surrounding stack frame can always be reused. Yeah, so therefore there's this moving before, and before that we just put the arguments. Yeah, so perhaps looking at the full code perhaps in a little bit of larger detail. So again, for the whole clause, you count please count the locals. So it is 3 in the head, and then auxiliary local variables h, x prime, and z prime, which are 3 more. Therefore, all together we have 6. So push and 6, therefore, is what we have here. And then we have to, the next thing is, we have to do code for these unification goals. So the first unification code is here. We put, I like to make it yellow, perhaps. Yellow for the unification code. Ah, yellow, I said. Yes, yellow. So that is for the left-hand side of the first unification thing. Then we do the constructor, the list constructor applied to h and x prime. So we have to use struct for this list constructor. And the first son is an uninitialized variable, namely the h. The second son is an uninitialized variable, namely the x prime, and then we go up. So you see here, this in that case, where under the top constructor, we only have variables, so the code looks very simple. And now comes the construction code, starting at B. So here is the construction code corresponding to the constructor, list constructor. So therefore, we have to construct the h, we have to construct the x prime, and then we have to construct the list. And afterwards, we have to bind. Yeah. So that is the construction code for the right-hand side of the first unification. Now comes the second unification. This is starting at C. So this is when the whole unification of the first unification starts ends. Then we go to the second unification statement, which starts at C. Now perhaps I kind of remove these other things here. And now comes the code for the second unification statement. Here the putref for the set, which is initialized, therefore a putref. Yeah, like the x, set is also initialized, so therefore a putref 3 for the third variable. Then we have to do the unification code for the right-hand side. This is, we use struct d, and the d, again, is the address of the construction code. Continuing. And then the first son is the initialized variable h. Therefore, URF4, followed by the uninitialized variable set prime, which is the last variable, and therefore UVAR 6. And then we go up, and the E is the address of the code after the unification, and that is the code after the unification is the code for the last call. This is the E. Okay, now comes the construction, starting from the E, so down there, this is now the construction code for the second unification. So first we have to check for, first we have to check, do the occur check. Now, why didn't we do the occur check for the first unification goal? Because H and X prime have been fresh, uninitialized, so therefore we did not recall we have to do the occur check only for the initialized variables in the term. So therefore the check here, the only initialized variable is the H, and therefore we have to check H. Therefore check 4. Yeah? Check 4. Before we do the, and on top of the stack we have the reference to the set, and therefore we have to do this checking, perhaps. Okay, the H and the set prime are put here, and here the construction of the list. And then here the binding. Okay, so these were the two unification codes, and now comes, starting from E, the code, the ultimate code for the recursive call, and therefore this is the last call, the last marking we have kind of completely abandoned because there is no backtrack point anymore, and therefore we kind of simply have to put the arguments, which are three variables, all initialized, therefore all put refs, and then we move the three things. We squeeze six elements out of the stack and move three elements down, and then we jump, and this is the recursive call. So in some sense, now you see here, this is really nothing else but a loop, which you have implemented here. One might even suspect that the whole last call optimization has only been invented to make the append function fast. So at least this is kind of an ideal example where this last call optimization works perfectly. Okay, is there a question? So that is one thing. Now, this last calling, once again, what is the benefit of it? The benefit of it is that we kind of reduce the amount of stack space. And stack space is a hot issue for Prolog implementations, so people have also have wondered whether one could even should do more to reduce the stack space, perhaps by already intermediately removing elements from the stack frame shrinking stack frames as soon as possible. In fact, that you could do in any language, I guess. This you could also do for C. If you have local variables, you might kind of organize the locals in your stack frame in such a way that as soon as a local X is no longer needed, you kind of squeeze it out of your stack. Yeah, so you kind of put that those which get are dead early. As you try to kind of reduce the stack pointer, and by that throwing away elements from the stack, you could try to do that, and by that gain something. So typically for C, one would not do it, because C is not known to be so notoriously stack consuming. blood. So therefore one might not want to do it. In functional languages it might be another thing, but also there you could do it. So here we did already squeeze out locals as soon as for let, introduced by let, as soon as the let is done. But we could even do it a little bit earlier already if we find out that, for example, the let is if it is not no longer needed, we might want to kind of look closer at the code, and when we find by code inspection that the variable is not needed, we try to throw it away. But also there it is not as popular as for Prolog programs, and let us see an example. So here is an example. Now this is kind of similar as this A function, A predicate, which we had a few slides ago, only that I called the predicates on the right-hand side P predicates, and you see here how this clause is organized. So A relates X and Z. And now in order to arrive at Z, you kind of a chain is constructed. So the X, the call of the predicate P1 relates X and an auxiliary X1. Then a call P2 relates the X1 to an X2. And then the next call relates X2 to X3 and so on. And only the last, Xn, kind of then affects the set. In some sense, if you like, this is a multiple natural join. In a kind of a chain of natural joins. And that's not so uncommon somehow. In this sense, because you have several things which are related and you need kind of several facts to kind of... which kind of fit together and kind of transport information, and only if you have the full chain then you have a relation. So in some cases this happens, so in some situations. But you notice here that the variable x1, for example, starts to be stops to be useful or to be live, I guess, actually here after the second literal. And so that is kind of x1. And x2 stops to be important or to be necessary after this literal. So here x2 is dead. Yeah? And so I might consider of throwing away x1 from my stack frame after the literal p2, and squeezing out the variable x2 after the literal p3. Yeah? So that one might think of. Okay? So for that, one might introduce a new instruction, trim. And trim kind of reduces the number of variables to m. Trim m reduces the number of variables to m. But clearly, this here you see that this trimming is not unconditionally possible, because it is only possible if no extra stack frames sit on top of the current stack frame. So if there's a backtrack point on top of the current the current stack frame, then we are doomed. Then we cannot kind of squeeze something out, because this would kind of introduce a hole in our stack, and we would kind of have to move kind of everything on top, also slide everything on top down, and this might be kind of expensive. So the check is we can only do this if the current frame pointer is, if there is no backtrack point on top, which means we can only do that here if the frame pointer is at most as big as the backtrack pointer. So we can, the current stack frame may be a backtrack point, that's fine, but it's not allowed that another backtrack point is sitting on top of the current stack frame. Yeah. Okay, now here for our, for this particular for this particular clause, we should in this we should kind of arrange the locals in such a way that those variables which drop dead first have the highest are sitting upmost in the stack frame, so therefore this means they have the highest relative addresses. So therefore the x1, although it is x1 and therefore occurs as the third variable, we give it the relative address 5. And the x2, which comes next, but sits, but also which drops dead in the as the second variable, it gets the second highest relative address. And then the remaining ones, okay, are filled in. Yeah, and that means here that the interesting thing is what we did here is we inserted these trim, the trim statements after the first literal, no, after the second literal and after the third literal. After the second literal, we trim the to 4. That means we squeeze out the fifth variable, and then we trim to 3, meaning we've squeezed out also the fourth variable. Yeah, and this code here is, well, this is the overall pushing of the environment, which is a push 5 because there are 5 variables. But this green thing is the first literal, and this green thing is the second literal, and this is the third, and this is the last literal. Yeah. And so in that sense, we have kind of inserted these trim instructions, and we can do that only after we have numbered, or we can do that after we have numbered the variables appropriately. So for that, we have to inspect how the we have to determine statically the life ranges, if you like, of variables, meaning the number of the last literal where the variable still is used occurs. And if it does no longer occur, then it's dead. Okay? So that was a little optimization, which might gain something. I guess I consider that as perhaps not so significant. But this one now is one of is of utmost importance. This is the clause indexing thing. The clause indexing thing, I guess today in 3 minutes we will not deal with it completely, but we will deal with it tomorrow. But here we can give you, I can give you the key observation. So the problem is, as we have described it now, we iterate through all the clauses one after the other. But that is expensive because there could be many clauses. And we always have to inspect all of them, although by close inspection, we see that it is not—it's not always possible that all of them match. Because, for example, there is a first if you look at the first argument in the first argument of the heads. So, for example, it is x. Then there is a unification literal saying x equals a in the first one, x equals b in the second clause, x equals c in the third clause. So I quickly write down, so p of x, x equals a, and then something, and the next clause looks like that, x equals b, and then something, and so on. And you see here, so this is kind of a case distinction on the argument X. And so if I see in my argument that there is a B, I definitely know that the first clause will never be taken. So I, introducing a backtrack point and first checking the first clause is completely ridiculous. So what we would like to have here is kind of the analogous thing to a switch statement. Yeah? Because we had no switch statement in Prolog so far. We want to have an inspection of an argument, look at the constructor, and then that deterministically choose the clause. We would like to have such a thing. And that is what clause indexing does. It is, in some sense, not a perfect thing, in that it typically decides for one of the arguments, or your predicates might have several, multiple arguments, not only one, as here, might have several arguments, and they come out, somehow the opportunistic and simple choice is done, you take the first argument, and then you do indexing for the top constructor of the first argument. Yeah? And then you kind of put the clauses into buckets, because there still could be multiple clauses where the first actual parameter starts with A. So like there could be multiple things like that here. But typically this is not the case. There's only one. And so in that sense, this clause indexing typically makes removes in some, that sense kind of you see the A in the first argument, and then there's typically only one alternative left. In this sense, the predicate, although defined by multiple clauses, turns out to behave deterministically. And this is good, because everything which is not deterministic is expensive. So although Prologue, the key feature of Prologue is non-determinism, the programmer tries to avoid non-determinism as much as possible. And this is kind of the contradiction inside Prologue programming. But that's enough for today, and tomorrow we look at clause indexing in detail. Thank you very much.